Good evening. Welcome to the Borgo Pass Horror Podcast. Enter freely and of your own will. In this episode, you may find many strange things, for the films to be discussed are old, and they have many memories. So, beware. Beware.
Hey everybody, welcome back to the Borgo Pass Horror Podcast. We're glad you're back here for a really unique episode. We're going to be talking about 1939's Tower of London, which is, as far as I know, Universal Horror's only attempt at doing kind of a historical drama and also a, in some ways, adaptation of a William Shakespeare play. Their take on one of the most famous, you know, plays and narratives that's ever, you know, hit the stage in across the world. It's the story of a disfigured member of the royal family who schemes and kills his way to the throne. It stars Basil Rathbone and Boris Karloff, freshly off of Son of Frankenstein, as well as John Sutton as John Wyatt, who we knew from Invisible Man Returns, Nan Gray, who from Dracula's Daughter, Invisible Man Returns as well, and it also stars Vincent Price in what I'm pretty sure is his first bit of screen appearance in for Universal Studios. Here we go. All right. My co-host today is our esteemed regular co-producer of the show, Livio Marino. Hey, Livio.
Howdy, howdy.
I forgot to mention it also stars the kid from Son of Frankenstein.
It does.
Who doesn't thankfully say, well, hello in this.
He doesn't speak, and I think that's intentional because no one in England sounded like that.
He says one word during the weird child marriage thing. He says one word like, I will. Yeah. It really comes off. I will. I'm so psyched to talk about this. This is when we started the show in 2021. This is just one of the weird ones. I was like, I gotta talk about Tower of London. It's such a goofball thing. And I also think I think it's one of my favorite Boris Karloff roles too. He's not in the film a ton, but when he's in it, you're not gonna miss him. And I think the makeup and his performance and you know the narrative of Mord the executioner, who is a fictional character that you know the film has inserted into this narrative as sort of an assistant to Richard, is such a unique thing, and it's just Karloff never did anything else kind of like this, did he?
I don't think so.
Like it's amazing. I mean, the closest maybe is
House of Rothschild, Bateman? Maybe.
Oh yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
as far as like a historical, I guess, but yeah, as far
yes,
as this,
yeah, there's that, yeah.
Yeah, this. I'm sorry, I misunderstood, but yeah, the no. This type of role. I mean, even Bateman, it was kind of against as well. I mean, Mord is just fully like, you know, he's fully
unsympathetic, right? Yeah,
unsympathetic, and he is on board with absolutely everything that Richard right. III is doing.
Yeah, yeah, it's a great performance for our our self dubbed Karloff King Karloff November here. I realized at some point we hadn't done a movie with Karloff in it in like 6 or 7 months, and I'm not sure how that happened. It wasn't on purpose. We just somehow skewed away from anything that he'd been doing, and I wanted to make up for that. So we just did. We released Abbott and Costello Meet the Killer Boris Karloff last week. We're doing this one this week, and we'll be following up with Isle of the Dead, the Val Luden produced RKO film starring Karloff in that'll be out in early December, actually. So, okay. Tower of London, based on the life of Richard III, who was the last. Hang on, I've got my historical notes here. Richard III, he lived from 1452 to 1485, dying at 32. He was the last king from the House of York, and he was the last of the Plantagenet dynasty of English monarchs. He was king for only 2 years. He was crowned only 2 years before his death at in battle. He was actually the last king of England to die in battle. He had scoliosis, they have found, because after he was killed in the battle, his body was buried without ceremony, yeah. and a marker was placed, and then the marker was taken away, and so his the Richard III's final resting place was lost for many, many years until 2012, when it was found under what I believe was a car park, which is what like the English call a parking lot.
Yeah.
Car park makes it sound so much nicer. It sounds like there's swings that cars are playing on and stuff, you know. Car park sounds so much nicer. They got that one right. But yeah, anyway, his body was found under a parking lot. And they did DNA testing to find that it was him. They did find that he did have scoliosis in the... So I guess the thing we got to talk about before we get going in the story here is... I absolutely love this version of the historical story of Richard III. And this was Roland V. Lee's attempt. Director Roland V. Lee was off of doing Son of Frankenstein, but he was really known for doing these historical epics. And he traveled to England looking, you know, researching this the life of this character. He and his brother had really kind of developed the project together, and he was really intent on doing this historical film based on the life of Richard III, within the way Universal did things, right? I mean,
so, yeah.
the studio at the time had a certain thing they did, and so naturally this thing was going to come off just with that tint of horror. The other most well-known, arguably better well-known version of the life of Richard III is The Tragedy of King Richard III, by William Shakespeare, which is written sometime about 1592, 1594, about 100 years after Richard III actually died. It's one of Shakespeare's longest plays. It started off as a history, it's classed as a tragedy now. I think just based on body count, I'm not sure. I think that's how that works. And it is, to my understanding, the only Shakespearean play where the main character is a villain. And he's not just like Prospero in The Tempest is a little bit morally bankrupt. Richard is a stone cold serial murderer.
Yeah, there's no redeeming quality there.
Yeah, he murders kids. I mean, he's an old people, and you know he's absolutely whatever. And he even says in the thing within the play, he says, "I plan to make myself a villain." That it's a purposeful decision on his part. I'm going to kill my way to the throne. So in so many ways, it's such a perfect story for Universal to adapt, because it already has that. It has a villain. I don't want to call him a monster just because Richard III had a physical deformity, but in the play, I think the idea is, and the idea definitely comes across in this film, I think Richard sees himself as a monster because of what he perceives as his physical deformity, his hunchback or his scoliosis. In the Shakespeare film, it becomes a hunchback, and he actually calls himself rudely stamped, deformed, and unfinished. And in a way, I guess it's his rationale. Like, I came into the world all messed up. Life wasn't fair to me. I'm going to take back what should be mine just because of that. So I think it's just perfect that Universal, you know, decided to have Roland V. Lee come in and do this film, you know, following Son of Frankenstein and some other stuff, reteam Karloff and Rathbone, and also just, and had Rathbone, who was such an incredible stage actor, to play this role, because this might be the best performance of like, as far as dramatic performance, not monster, not whatever, like maybe the most quality high-end performance of a character in almost any of the Universal monster canon. It's just Rathbone's amazing in this.
He is, and I was gonna mention that how much more I like him in this movie compared to Son of Frankenstein. And and it's not that because he did great in Son of Frankenstein. He's very over the top and theatrical and all, you know, all the things, but he just seems so much more comfortable in this type of story, in this type of setting. And I mean, you don't, when I watch Son of Frankenstein, I'm seeing Basil Rathbone as Wolf Frankenstein. But when I watch Tower of London, I just see Richard III, you know, it is
right.
So.
No, yeah, that's interesting. Yeah. I do think that Son of Frankenstein, as much as I love it, and we had such a great time talking about it, I'm not sure Rathbone knew what he was trying to do in that. We've talked about this a little bit. I think everyone was kind of trying to out-act each other
yeah.
a little bit. And he, so many of his scenes are with Lugosi, who's not an under-actor
same thing with Lionel Atwell.
Yes. And Lionel Atwell, yeah, exactly. And there are great moments of performance there, but I think it comes down to the writing a lot. I think the dialogue Richard has to in this film in Tower of London is so subtle that Rathbone gets to really underplay everything, and he gets to do this thing where so many times in the movie, and I was going to wait to talk about this later, but I just want to get into it now. Like Basil Rathbone could be doing one thing with one eye, and he's giving a different performance with the other eye. You know what I mean? Like he's literally doing two things at once, and you can see him doing the two things at once. There's this deafness to what he's doing here that is so wonderful, and it's just amplified by he's got a very odd period wig on with these weird little bangs and stuff, and he's all dressed in black, which is pretty traditional for the character in the Shakespearean plays as well, to set him off, and he's in this big tunic which is supposed to cover up the hump on his back, which is, to be honest, in this film is pretty subtle. It's probably closer to the reality than some of the Shakespearean versions have been, because when they found the body and did the test, they did, again, found he had scoliosis, but they said it probably was something that under clothes wouldn't have been quite as noticeable. So it's not like he's Quasimodo, right? I guess is the thing. But again, it's that thing that he perceives it. He perceives it as his own monstrosity, and it connects him with Mord, the character played by Boris Karloff, who has a club foot.
Yeah.
And this great appliance thing where he's got this gigantic foot, and Karloff really he's constantly letting you, he reminds you of it when he's walking down the stairs, he's picking it up and stuff. It makes him no less physically intimidating. He seems as big physically in this film as he does in the Frankenstein monster role.
He's
terrifying.
Yeah. And he also seems so much more youthful than Son of Frankenstein. And I don't know. And I guess that's a little bit credit to Jack Pierce and how, because for Frankenstein, Bride of Frankenstein, Son of Frankenstein, all three makeups for the monster had subtle differences. Yes. And I think a lot of celebration, rightfully so, gets put on the monster's makeup in Bride of Frankenstein because of the burn and then the regrowth movie goes on, all that. But I'm not sure many people give a lot of attention to the makeup in Son of Frankenstein and how much older the monster looks a bit more, I don't want to say frail, but just worn. And if you put Karloff as the monster in Son of Frankenstein next to Mord, it almost looks like they're 5 years apart instead of, Son of Frankenstein actually coming first.
Yeah. He's got a gauntness back in his face a little bit. And maybe that's because of the bald head appliance going over his hair. The crown of his head is just a little bit bigger, so it makes his lower half of his body, of his face rather, look a little tinier. They have him in this tunic and then these tights, and his legs look very narrow, which I do think makes him look taller, kind of, because then he looks like he has these long legs, and I think physically. But then when he's standing next to Basil Rathbone, you see they're almost the same height. So, it's more what the camera's doing than what the costume and makeup's doing than his actual physical. Who was 5'11", I believe.
Yeah.
Karloff. Yeah, he's 5'11", and Lugosi was 6 foot or something. Mm-hmm.
It's a weird thing. I've talked about this before, how, I can't remember what happened in a work meeting that I'm on an hour ago, but I can remember the heights of actors that lived 100 years ago.
Of course. Exactly. It's all about your priorities.
Exactly.
What you've kept. Exactly. All right. The film starts out with a view of the Tower of London, which is it's based on a real place, and it is actually where people were kept prisoner back in the day in the Middle Ages in London. It's kind of just a museum now, as far as I know. And if I remember the one sequence in Spider-Man Far From Home, Or I think they get trapped in the Tower of London and there's like a robot or something. I'm not sure.
Isn't I don't remember. This is probably this will take us down a rabbit hole, so stop me. But I think I'm trying to remember that I think Tower of London was actually last had someone in prison there. I think in the 80s, and it wasn't it the Nazi Rudolf Hess, the one that tried to
was it really
defect over from Germany? He tried to fly over to England to secretly negotiate peace or surrender or something with England, and didn't happen. But
I don't know about that, but I can guarantee you I'm going to be Wikipediaing that as soon as we're done talking, because that's kind of fascinating.
I'm pretty sure.
I've never thought about when the last time someone was imprisoned there, so we should look that into that. I have the feeling one of our listeners probably knows a lot more about it than we do naturally.
Probably so, yeah.
We attract this kind of like very studied clientele. It's very interesting, this listenership. Again, Roland V. Lee is a producer and director. This film had a $500,000 budget, so they Universal wanted to put some money into this, and I think it was because it was a bit of a historical drama and it had a little bit of notoriety as opposed to the Mad Ghoul, right? You know, even in 39, they are Universal is still trying a little bit to do some of these A pictures that can be taken seriously. And this film was very well regarded when it came out. It was critically acclaimed in several trade papers. It gives you a little history of the Tower of London, where people were imprisoned and blah, 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 and really sets you up for what is going to be a movie with a lot of court intrigue, which is historically accurate, which is faithful to the Shakespeare version. There's a lot of double dealing and lying and conniving and tricking and lying, you know, betrayal and murder, obviously. You know, if done right, it's pretty engaging and fun. And if done wrong, it can be pretty tiresome on film and in on the stage and in literature. So, luckily, I think the writing tends to simplify a little bit the historical, story that it's based on, and it tends to discard a lot of the extraneous stuff in Richard III, which even a lot of theatrically produced versions of Richard III nowadays discard a lot of stuff because it's a very long play and it's very dense, and there's like 70 characters in it that, you know, are pretty tough to keep track of. So, you know, this film does a great job of, you know, streamlining it into a kind of gripping narrative with some action and some drama and some horror in it. And then some comedy too. We have Ernest Cossart as Tom Klink, the chimney sweep character. And he brings a little bit of like joy to what could be a pretty dark film.
And a great arc too, for how his character actually ends up, you know, how he kind of ends up as part of the resistance,
really,
you know? Yeah.
right. Part of the resistance. Exactly. It's really exciting. Okay. So I'm going to try and get through the story of it without making it necessary for everyone to totally keep track of the narrative. This is a 10th time watching this film, at least for me. And yet every time I'm still like, wait, what's happening? Cause it gets confusing. And the problem is people have the same names, and that's the problem. It's like, so Edward IV is king right now. He is Richard's brother, and he's also brother to the Duke of Clarence, who's played by Vincent Price. He's played by Ian Hunter. So Ian Hunter, Basil Rathbone, and Vincent Price are all brothers. Ian is the oldest. Ian is the king.
And I was thinking about this, and this is maybe one of the things where our listeners can correct me, because I might be getting this wrong, but I'm pretty sure that Ian Hunter's name was in consideration either for the role of Dracula, either in the original or in Abbott Costello Meet Frankenstein.
Yes, he was. I think you are right. I've heard that, and I want to say it was for the original.
That's what I thought too,
and that would make sense because he's a little middle aged at this point. It would have made sense if he was a little bit younger. And you know, it's funny because I remember reading that and never quite, you know, I know like Conrad Veidt was in the running for it, and a few other actors that I recognized, but Ian Hunter's name I didn't, because I don't think he did a whole lot of Universal horror. I think he did other Universal type films that were maybe more serious and stuff. He played Richard a year earlier, I think, on stage. Ian Hunter had. So I think he was also a theatrical actor. Edward is king. He's deposed King Henry VI, who's an old man, and he's got, it seems like, what he has what we would now call, like, kind of senile dementia.
Yeah.
Lord de Vere is to be executed, and I think he has something to do with Henry. And so as the film starts out, an execution is about to happen. And we go down in the basement, and we get our first glimpse of Boris Karloff as Mord the Executioner, and he's sharpening his axe on a grind wheel. He's got a real freaking crow on his shoulder he's like talking to and complaining at and stuff, which is amazing. So offhand, he's just like, get off there, whatever. Like, it's like he's had this crow on it. Like, it's like Boris Karloff's had this, lived with this crow for years. Like, it's so casual. He's like, they don't make a big deal. He's like, oh, just get off, crow. You know? Again, he's got this bald cap. He's got this prosthetic nose that makes it look almost like a beak of like a bird of prey. It's this total like hooked nose he's got.
Bushy eyebrows. He's got
the clubfoot thing, the tights. Yeah, bushy eyebrows and stuff. It's just an amazing thing. He's doing an accent that I haven't quite heard him do in a lot of other films and stuff. I don't know what it's based on or where the region it's located at or something, but he's really doing it, whatever. But he's a great character because, how do I say this? Mord found the perfect job for himself. He loves what he does.
He
loves torturing people. He loves hurting people. He loves killing people. He's the whole time he's constantly complaining, like, I want to go into battle with Richard, because he's like, I want to kill blood, on a battlefield.
He wants to kill in warm blood, not cold blood.
Yeah, warm blood, not cold blood. Yeah. He's tired of just executing people, you know, on the block and stuff, you know, cutting their heads off with his axe and stuff. He wants to kill people, you know, that have a chance of killing him back. He wants the sport of it. He just delights in it. And it's so perfectly epitomized in the moment where it's time for him to go up there and execute Lord de Vere. And he's walking out, and he's passing this guy who's laying on his back with all these heavy
giant
wooden
weights.
Like iron weights on him. He just pauses and casually picks one up and puts another one on top of him. The guy's like, oh, it's like he's checking, if the soup's cooking right or something. It's just so casual. It's just so
something he'd do on a normal Wednesday. Yeah, exactly.
Yes, this is a normal Wednesday for Mord. He's a dangerous guy, and his one absolute loyalty is to Richard, Duke of Gloucester. It's spelled Gloucester, but they say Gloucester, so we're gonna say Gloucester. yes. So, as he's headed up, as Mord's headed up to the execution, we find Edward, the king, and Richard, his brother, who played by Basil Rathbone, are having a sparring match. They're in like a ring, kind of like almost like a boxing ring.
Yeah.
And they're fighting with spears. They're armored up and they're fighting with spears. And all of the king's attendants are like, dude, take it easy. 'Cause they're really going at it. Like Richard actually almost nails him once. Clarence, Vincent Price's character, is their brother, is watching, and Richard almost clocks him with
his
spear
off,
by mistake. Yeah, and he's like, oh, Richard almost killed me. And Edward's like, if he'd meant to kill you, you'd be dead. Like, that's, you know. So they set up that Richard is a devastatingly dangerous opponent on the battlefield with a spear, with a sword, with anything. And this is really in keeping with Basil Rathbone's actual persona in real life, generally regarded as he was an expert fencer. He'd been doing it for decades. He's generally considered possibly the best swordsman that's ever been seen on screen in cinema. Not that his duels are the best things that ever done, but he himself was as skilled as anyone who's ever done a sword fight in a film. He was known for saying that in his several films that he did with Errol Flynn, that he was known for saying that he could have killed Errol Flynn at any time he wanted to. had he wanted to. But apparently those two got along. They got along pretty well, but he didn't think Errol Flynn took the fighting as seriously as he could have, and he kind of depended on his natural kind of athleticism.
Yeah.
Rathbone himself was a technician.
Yeah. And I think there was also a kind of a, maybe an insinuation. I don't think Errol Flynn took it quite as seriously, nor do I think he was as skilled. I think Rathbone, being as skilled as he was able to essentially mask that for Errol Flynn and make him look as good as he did.
I think so.
I know with, if you ever watch any movie with Christopher Lee, and I think it's his left hand, his pinky finger is crooked, and that's the result of a sword fight with Errol Flynn,
who makes sense.
Was not as careful as maybe he should have been.
Yes. There's also a bit of a chance that Errol Flynn might have been a little tipsy at many of these moments,
too. I know probably more of a chance, but yes.
Yes. It's that thing of, like, I think Errol Flynn had the 10,000-hour thing that we talk about with sword fighting, but I think Basil Rathbone had the 100,000-hour thing.
Yeah.
So yeah. Rathbone was a war hero. He'd fought in World War I and been decorated. He was also an LGBT advocate, even back in this day. I think there's a lot of speculation that he might have been bisexual. I'm not sure if that's just whatever, a rumor, or if that's just, I don't know what. And who cares? I'm just saying, he was a very progressive person even back here in the 1930s, 40s. He's famous for playing Sherlock Holmes. He'd obviously played Wolf Frankenstein in Son of Frankenstein.
Yeah.
He was a radio star. He was a stage star and everything like that. He was a big deal, and I think he's a good get for Universal in this thing. And like you were saying, Livio, like I think also the deafness of his performance in this film has something to do with, I think he really was happy getting to do this part. I think this was something way up his alley.
Oh gosh, yes. And because he does so many things, and this may come off as I'm downplaying his performance in Son of Frankenstein. I'm not at all. I think he does fantastic in that.
Right.
But he does so much more with this role. So many like little details, the way his voice inflection will change, the way he moves around. He's, like I said, he's become Richard III, and just – everything from the first time you see him to how he's fences to,
yes,
you know, later on in the movie where he's kind of conniving and manipulating the boy king and all that stuff. It's all so,
right,
so perfectly done.
Yes, yes, yes. The only sad thing about this role is when he committed to this role, it meant that he couldn't be in Hunchback of Notre Dame with Charles Laughton, and where I think he would have played
Frollo.
Frollo, yeah, thank you. I think he would have been an amazing Frollo, but I think who played him?
Sir Cedric Hardwick.
Yeah, Cedric Hardwick did a great job.
Cedric Hardwick, of course, ends up being the second son of Frankenstein in Ghost of Frankenstein. So it's a small world.
it's the inbreeding that goes.
It all goes back to the Frankenstein family tree.
The last thing I want to say, I neglect about Basil Rathbone. If you do want to see a great Basil Rathbone fight scene, his fight with Tyrone Power in Mark of Zorro is exceptional. They're fighting with almost like foils, more like rapiers, less like the big broadswords like in Adventures of Robin Hood. And it's fast and quick and so entertaining. It's great. So Lord De Vere is about to be executed, and John Wyatt shows up, and John Wyatt wants to go stand on the platform with him because he's his cousin and no one else is standing up for him. So John Wyatt's played by John Sutton, who we know as from The Invisible Man Returns as
Dr. Griffin.
What was his name in Invisible Man Returns?
Dr. Griffin.
Dr. Griffin, but he's, yeah, I can't remember. Yeah, exactly.
Is his uncle or something.
Son, nephew, grandson, yeah, whatever, to Jack Griffin. And he's great in this. John's great in this. He goes and stands up there. Now John Wyatt is in love with Alice, who is the queen's, I don't know, niece or something like that. Queen Elizabeth is the queen of, is the wife of King Edward.
Yes.
It gets tricky. Alice is worried that John's going to do this because it's going to kind of make him look bad because Lord Devere is being executed because he's an enemy of the king. So if John stands up there with him, then it means it makes him look kind of an enemy of the king. So,
and you see pretty quickly on, you know, during the scene, this execution scene, that because I think it's well established right from the start that Richard is a little, you know, unscrupulous and doesn't have a good moral compass. But I think in this execution scene and the scenes that follow, you get the sense that King Edward is kind of the same way.
Yeah. Edward's cold and calculating. I'm not sure he's as just completely moralless as, you know, he has a few moments where he shows a little bit more humanity. And that's something that his younger brother Richard just doesn't have. Like, you know, Richard is a psychopath. He has no regard for anyone else's life or anything. He's got a little. Okay, we'll get to the cabinet. But here's the deal. Okay, there's a great scene. Where Lord Devere, you know, says, you know, he goes up to Karloff and he's like, you know, I know it's customary to pay the execution for a good stroke. And he says, like, here's a groat. It's the smallest coin I know. Do your worst, which is just like,
no, oh, yeah.
So, you know, brazen and you know, Karloff spits on it and throws it. And, you know, so Lord Devere dies well. We obviously don't see we see the axe come down. We don't see the effects of it. And he calls out, Edward as a usurper from the stage. And then, you know, the guy running the execution says, like, you know, look, you're going to get John Wyatt in trouble. Just, you gotta tone it down a little bit, because it's this court thing where anything, you know, the more Wyatt seems to be in league with this Devere and Devere's side of the, because there's different families basically trying to vie for who's in charge of the crown and stuff at this point. Right. We're historically in the middle of what's called the War of the Roses, which goes on for, I think, like 100 years or something. Devere's killed. Everyone, you know, and they make a point of showing like the crowd and people like, oh, this is my 25th execution. I've been, yeah. It's like WrestleMania, right? For them. It's the closest thing they got. I guess jousting would have been more like WrestleMania. This is more like seeing the Rolling Stones or something. I don't know what.
The kid chimney sweep's trying to watch it, and he keeps pushing it. Like, you
yes, yeah, watch yeah. It. We're introduced yeah. to Tom Clink and the little chimney sweep kid, and the kid's like, "Oh, I want to watch it." And he's like, and he's got a great line, like, you know, keep your black face, but don't have a black heart, or something like that.
Yeah.
Which is nice. Richard Morge reports to Richard afterwards in Richard's chambers, and Richard congratulates him on a good stroke, throws him some money, and they talk about their connection. Within the film, Richard says, like, you know, points himself. He's like Crookback and Dragfoot.
Yeah. I think that's the only reference, really. Because I know when I only saw this, or I only watched this once or twice when I was a kid, because it just didn't hold my interest. Like, you know,
it's not the Wolfman, not like does. Frankenstein. Yeah, of course.
But that kind of, and I'm not super familiar with the historical aspects of this time period or of this story, but I know that. That line stuck out to me when I watched it again before we were talking about it here. About he calls himself, you know, Crookback and what did he say, Dragfoot and all that.
Calls him Dragfoot, yeah, for his clubfoot, yeah. And this is my thing of like, they see themselves as the other, right? They see themselves as that I guess for all intents and purposes, like God made them monsters, so why not behave like a monster? Is there rationale? And it's the closest thing we get to a rationale. In this film, besides just basic greed, besides the idea that Richard wants the crown, again in the Shakespeare play, he's basically just bored in court, and he's like, I don't know, I'm going to stir up some trouble, so I'll just kill a bunch of people and try and become king. He almost does it for his own amusement in the play, which I think to a 20th century audience doesn't quite hold up.
Like, yeah,
there has to be a little bit of a stronger motivation than just he's just entertaining himself by killing children and whatnot and old people and stuff. So
yeah, he's got a definite purpose here. You can tell that the whole desire to be king and just to be the
yes.
end all be all ruler of everything is his motivating yes. factor. And he will stop at nothing to to achieve, no, achieve that. I do want to say before we get too much farther, the execution scene, it reminded me of some of the stories I've read about. I want to say it was when Henry VIII was, you know, coming to power and, or not coming to power, but when he was in power and he was ordering executions, how depending on who he had ordered to be killed, if this person wasn't liked, they'd go out and get the executioner just totally wasted, drunk like the night before. Yeah. And, you know, there's like reports of just this extremely hungover, half drunk executioner missing, you know, and like hitting the back
yes.
And all stuff that's, like that.
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh, that's probably something that Mord would have maybe done intentionally for his little, you know.
Yeah. Mary, Queen of Scots, supposedly, I think I remember reading that the first time they execute, when Elizabeth the First had Mary, Queen of Scots executed, the executioner missed and basically put the axe in the back of her skull.
Oh, yeah.
And had to pull it out and couldn't get it out a little bit. Like, had to really wrench it out of the back of her head and then, you know, and then put it through. So, yeah. I mean, can you imagine? It caught on a necklace of some kind or something like that. You all have to look up the grisly details of that story. But I remember my 7th grade history teacher explaining that to us.
What'd you learn in school today? Well.
Yeah. Well, you know, Mary, Queen of Scots. No. So Richard, just like every quality serial killer, he's got a little cabinet and it's got these little dolls in it. And he's got this little, diorama set up of like a throne and some steps going down in a little throne room. And he's got these little dolls that represent all these people. So, and it's a great visual explanation. I think it's brilliantly put in there just to help us keep the story clear, because there's a lot of names, there's a lot of intrigue, there's a lot of whatever. And here's the idea is, so Richard is the Duke of Gloucester. He's the brother of the king, but he's 6th in line to succession to the throne.
Yeah.
There are 5 people between him and the king, including the king. So there's the king, there's Henry Tudor. No, is Henry Tudor later? No, it's the Prince of Wales.
Yeah.
There's the Prince of Wales.
Henry who's the
there?
Sixth.
There's Henry's. Yeah, Henry VI, the paper crown king. There's the 2 kids of his brother, his nephews, and there's the Duke of Gloucester, which is Vincent Price's character. So he sets it up. He's like, okay, this is who I have to get out of the way, including Edward himself,
yeah,
to become king. It's and he ends up, the only one he ends up, the only one he ends up kind of not killing is really Edward, because Edward eventually dies on his own. So, but again, it's just the long game. He's not going to do it all at once. He's not going to like just go on a kill crazy rampage. He's going to bide his time, and he's going to do it one by one by one and take his time and his ascension to the throne. By the way, the Netflix show House of Cards that starred Kevin Spacey.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Was actually based on a British show called House of Cards, which was based on Richard III, the play. The whole idea is of this guy who's just like the whip in one of the houses of parliament, finding a way, not through necessarily murder in that story, and through intrigue, in getting everyone out of the way until he can become prime minister. So,
yeah. You know. And it's
a classic story. Yeah.
Yeah. And even one thing that struck out to me is, I mean, because some of this stuff, as far as who's in succession to take over the throne, the actual throne of England, you know, it's somewhat topical with the recent death of the queen, and then seeing, yes, you know, who actually is in line, who, you know, and that's what right. That's what I thought of when, you know, he opened up this cabinet and you see, because, you know, there's Charles, but then I think the next is William, but then Harry's way down the line. And then, you know, he's got brothers and sisters in the two. So it's hard. Me as an American, it's hard for me to understand. Yes.
But I think it's fascinating for us as Americans because, frankly, no disrespect, but frankly, it's so weird. It's yeah. just weird how there's these rules and the rules seem to be able to be changed and it depends on whatever and stuff. So it seems malleable, but these rules are just sort of self-inflicted. They're not, you know, I mean, I guess there's this implication that they're rules handed down from on high for the British monarchy and have been, you know, but it seems like every time, like, say, Henry VIII wanted to change the rules, he managed to kill somebody, one of his wives, or have her divorced, even though divorce wasn't allowed. So he changes the Church of England, you know, and makes divorce okay. It seems like there was always this ability to, like, change the rules so that they what they want to have happen happens. But again, it's a story of people who are ungoverned, right? Because there's no
exactly.
law.
Yeah, there's no
that can affect
and
these people. They're above everything. They're above, you know, whatever. Even sort of the will of the people. They don't have to abide by. They get to do what they want. And so it sets up the possibility of someone who comes in who's completely amoral. To you know, just be able to cut a swath through this with, you know, and not face immediate repercussions.
Yes.
Anyway, maybe, like, I don't know, some relative of the queen who tends to like children. I don't know. seemingly very few repercussions. I don't understand it, but okay. I'm just saying. anyway, we go back to, so John and Alice are in love and they want to be married. They're on the queen's side. So the Queen Elizabeth, Edward's wife, Richard's sister-in-law, is from, like, another side of the family. And Edward married her to kind of bring her side of the family kind of into his. There's a lot of the subtext and sort of, there's even some dialogue in the film about how Edward is trying to, like, consolidate power, and the consolidate power, like, his quote, he's got a great quote. He says, "Marry your enemies and behead your friends."
Yeah.
which is that, you know, this isn't really done for dramatic purposes. This is really kind of how this worked. There was a lot of, yeah, like I said, like, plotting, scheming, what have you, convenient marriages of convenience and things like that. That were done to keep and maintain power. And in so doing, creating just a little bit of inbreeding. so this is why, like the Austro-Hungarian empire almost fell, just because the Habsburgs were so inbred that they started having all these genetic problems. This is why the Tsar Nicholas II's son had hemophilia, because they were all inbred. You know, it wasn't known then as well, but obviously now we know that certain genetic traits are passed down through, you know, through the blood, through DNA, through from the male, from the female, and that certain arrangements, if those people are too closely related, the recessive genes can sometimes become dominant genes, and then suddenly you have, or whatever, and then you have birth defects coming up. So anyway, John and Alice want to run away and get married, but they want to stay because they're on the queen's side. The queen, Queen Elizabeth, the whole time, she knows how dangerous Richard is. She's the only one who really sees, which I like.
Mother's intuition, I mean, literally.
Yeah, Barbara O'Neill. Sorry, Barbara O'Neill just gives a great performance the whole way through as someone who's just, she is just onto Richard's shit the whole time from the beginning. She knows, she sees him briefly just in the room with her sons and is terrified and says, did he touch them? She's horrified him because she just knows what he's capable of, I think. And no one else, everyone else has fooled themselves into believing, like, the whole court and the people running the court and all the attendants and Edward himself and everybody. Clarence is the only one who sort of gets, because Clarence, I guess, grew up with Richard and he knows, like, what Richard's capable, the cruelty Richard's capable of. But Elizabeth's really the one. So John and Alice feel like they have to stick around and you know, keep an eye on her. John wants to go and ask the king to be able to be marry Alice. They're interrupted by what the young chimney sweep accidentally falls down the chimney and comes out all dusty, and the old chimney comes out, and there's this whole thing, which is great because it does set up Tom Clink. He introduces himself by name to them, and Tom Clink, again, like we said earlier, is going to play into the thing before. I'm not sure why all chimney sweeps sound like Dick Van Dyke, but
they do. Maybe Dick Van Dyke just sounds like all chimney sweeps.
Maybe Dick Van Dyke sounds like all chimney sweeps. This is true. Oh, we're sorry, milady. It's great. Oh my. Sorry, everyone in England, for that. So John goes to ask the king's permission to marry Alice, but the king and Richard.
That was kind of weird because, you know, literally just executed his friend and he's kind of knows like, yeah, you know, that's not a great look for you. And then he's like, well, I'm going to go ask him for permission to marry this person. And
his timing could be better.
Yeah.
It's true. It's true. John's a little, there's a little bit of a David Manners thing going on here with him for John White for some of the film. And then he kind of rallies a little bit at the end, a bit. I mean, he does sort of get the final coup d'etat in there or whatever, but coup de grace, sorry. So he goes and tries to ask the king to let him marry Alice. The king instead says he's going to marry this lady who he says her grandson is older than him. So she's a dowager, so she has money. So the king has decided to sort of take his revenge on John by A, not letting him marry Alice, but also marrying him to somebody who's going to sort of bring some wealth into his own coffers and this idea. John refuses, and he's taken to the tower, and he's in trouble. Again, like Rathbone plays this whole scene like he's the one who put the king up to it. And then when the king is finally talking to John, he's just standing there like looking around, minding his own, you know, totally innocent, you know. But we can tell how much he's enjoying the fact that John White's life is being ruined. Right?
I mean, he's a master of puppets. I mean, is the start because he does it several times throughout this movie. And he does that where he'll really quickly whisper something into, you know, King Edward's ear or an idea, because he knows he can tell how each person's going to react. And then he just stands back and just kind of lets it all happen. Reminds me a little bit of Igor, you know, when all the people that convicted him die, but he's like, wasn't me. I was under observation the entire time, you know?
Under time. Yeah. All innocent. Right. Yeah, exactly. But he's still, he's enjoying that. And it's the same thing here. Richard's enjoying that. John White knows Richard's behind it, but can't prove that Richard's behind it. And he's enjoying that John knows that he's screwing him, but can't say anything about it. Like that's the extra thing. He's enjoying screwing him, but he's also enjoying that John knows he did it and he can't prove it. So yeah, that's, it's just, he's wonderfully evil. I mean, we do sort of enjoy seeing how evil he is, and we enjoy seeing how clever he is too. That's the other thing, is he's actually so smart.
Yes.
And he's, you know, again, he's doing, it's that thing where they talk about like 3D chess or something. Like he's playing this game that no one else has really figured out. And cause no one really gets that he's working his way to the throne. They just think he's a crappy person, I guess. Except for the queen. Again, the queen is the one who's just onto him. I mean, maybe she doesn't know his goal, but she gets that how dangerous
she knows what he's capable of, at least.
Yes. The old paper crown king, the Henry the sixth, his son is the Duke of Wales. Or the Prince of Wales. He shows up and he's going to mount a battle and he's going to try to reclaim the throne and save his dad, who is a prisoner in the Tower of London currently. And who, again, like I said, is senile.
And he's played by, Miles Mander. So, which interesting when I rewatched this, cause I hadn't seen this in years, but when I rewatched it, I'm like, you know, it kind of looks like Miles Mander, but I'm like, nah, maybe not. Cause the voice was off and it threw me, but then I look and it's him. So Miles Mander was the, Scotland Yard detective or inspector, in Return of the Vampire. He's also Pleyel, the music publisher in the 43 Phantom of the Opera.
Whoa. Interesting. I wanted to mention 43 Phantom of the Opera because I was thinking, is this the only time Universal Horror had a character based on an actual historical figure besides Franz Liszt in 43 Phantom of the Opera, right? They have the guy playing him in the music shop, right? When Claude Rains goes crazy and burns the thing and stuff. Who's about to discover Claudin. Possibly they're only really based on historical person. post a thing on social media. If I'm wrong, correct me. I'm happy. So there's a battle that's going to happen. Richard figures out a way to get to convince Henry to go into battle with them on their side. So they're going to spread that news to the crowd, and they're going to be like, "Oh, Henry the Sixth is you know, the old king is actually going into battle with the new king against his own son." Meanwhile, the old guy has no idea where he's going and what he's doing. They've just manipulated him. They've dressed him in armor and let him go in there, and
yeah,
let him
thinking he's going
to have his like, final.
Yeah, I think he's going to get just slaughtered.
Yeah. But you know, poor Henry, I was going to say, thinks he's going to be king again.
Yeah.
And meanwhile, he's just poor guys wandering around the battle. No one's even like trying to kill him. I think the idea is that he's going to go get killed in battle, and they're going to get him out of the way that way. But he manages to not get killed in battle because he's wandering around bumping into stuff the entire time. No one feels like taking a minute to stab him, I guess. And it's a sad little scene where he's in the battlefield and, you know.
As his son, the Prince of Wales, dies by Richard.
His son, the Prince of Wales, dies. Yeah, yes. It does have the effect. Richard and Wales have a sword fight on a bridge, which is a really good sword fight. It's not, again, not the best, but it's not the best of Rathbone's career. But it's a nicely staged battle. It's pretty quick, and there's some deftness. They're fighting in full armor, and they're fighting with these little swords and stuff. But yes, Richard manages to kill Wales, so that's one less person on his way in his way to the crown. Wales, for his part, Wales comes out and he's like, "Oh, I'm going to go kill everybody." He seems like a bit of a doof. I'm not sure like what he, if he's possibly a little optimistic, thinking like, "Oh, I'm just going to go have this battle and everything's going to work." He seems like kind of a goofball. But he's married. Okay, he's married to Anne Neville, who was Richard's childhood sweetheart. And so Richard has this whole idea, like it's this 3D chess he's playing, where he's kind of going to kill two birds with one stone. He's gonna take out someone who's in his way to the throne, but he's also going to kill the husband of the woman he actually loves. And it's the only even close to real redeeming bit in Richard is that he still does have this, you know, affection to this woman that he knew as a child, Anne Neville. But he finds a way pretty soon to get her to marry him in his own way, which is better than the play, because in the play he kills her dad and then proposes to her over the corpse of her dad and tricks her into marrying him after he's murdered her dad, and her dad's wounds have started bleeding again as he's it's a whole thing. They had a lot of trouble with the battles in the film. They do the Battle of Tewkesbury, and they do a battle of it's the one where he dies in a Battle of Bosworth.
Yeah.
And one of them, I can't keep straight. One of them, they had fog, and it was so windy that the fog was just blowing into the camera and you just couldn't see anything. They had a lot of trouble with that and a lot of delays. And then the other one, they had rain. I think it's Battle of Tewkesbury. They had rain, and no one had, you're not sure how this kind of thing happens on a big film like this, but they had made most of the helmets of the soldiers out of cardboard. And when the rain towers started going and the rain and the water hit the cardboard helmets just started like falling apart. Yeah. And so it was just a fiasco. They had like 400 extras out there. And from something I'd read about one of the line producers or editors, they'd possibly just cast a little bit in the wrong way, and the people they brought in to play the soldiers were kind of unruly and kind of aggressive, and they had just a lot of issues filming these battles. And it's part of why this film went $80,000 over budget. It went quite a bit over budget and over schedule, or I don't know if it's over schedule. I think Roland Lee managed to bring it in vaguely on schedule, but it did go quite a bit over budget. And he had a reputation for going over budget and over schedule for these films. So he's kind of in trouble with Universal at this point. And I'm not sure if this film helped it or not, but he does go on and does Son of Monte Cristo after this. He does a lot more.
One thing that I always found curious is that I know Roland Lee really, really enjoyed Bela Lugosi as Igor, and he expanded mm-hmm. his time, expanded his role, and I don't know if it's just because with Lugosi's accent, it just didn't fit this movie, yeah. which I could see, but I always kind of wondered why he didn't, because he used a lot of others from Son of Frankenstein, but why he didn't,
did, yeah.
why Lugosi wasn't brought in for this one.
Yeah, it was interesting. I don't know if, like, well, you know, they brought in Karloff, so there was this idea, like, okay, well, like, it's difficult if you have both of them, maybe. I don't know. I'm not sure what yeah, exactly. I don't wonder. And you wonder what interesting bit, we have, what's his name from Black Cat? Harry Cording comes yes. in at the end. Harry Cording's the one who actually kills the little kids. He does. I don't know if he has maybe one or two lines. He doesn't have a big part. But wonder, like, could that have been Lugosi's part? You don't know. It would have been interesting. Like, could have given him like long hair or something, and had him be like a ragged guy or something. I think it would have been fantastic. But yeah, I don't know. It's interesting. Because it is. It's basically everyone from The Invisible Man Returns and everybody from
Son of Frankenstein. It's a good mesh of 30s and 40s Universal. Really.
Yeah. No. Yeah. For sure. I mean, and it's a lot of the music was brought over from Son of Frankenstein, so there's quite a bit of recycled music.
So, fun fact: so Son of Frankenstein, which came before this movie, obviously. So the musical score was written by Hans Salter and Frank Skinner, Charles Previn was credited as the musical director. He had worked on it too. So for Tower of London, Hans Salter actually wrote an original score, and it would have been his first kind of solo score for this, but the studio rejected it. And as a result, they wound up reorchestrating and reusing most of the Son of Frankenstein score. Yeah. So I think a part of that
brought in Skinner, and Skinner had like a week. So he's like, okay, well, we're just going to be doing this.
Yeah. So they had, which always makes me curious. I would have loved to have heard what that would have been. Salter's first score on his own would end up being Son of Frankenstein about 3 years after this, Ghost of Frankenstein. I just thought that was because obviously with this big a budget, they wanted I think they wanted more of an original score, but for whatever reason that whoever didn't like it.
My understanding, I think it's on IMDb or something, or maybe Wikipedia, is that Salter's score came in and it was very period correct. Mm-hmm. For the era, Universal wanted something a little more contemporary and dramatic. And I think in a way I get that, because while again, they're trying to do this kind of historic epic story, it's got Boris Karloff in it. It's got Basil Rathbone. You want to connect it somehow to everything else you're doing. Like, you want it to have that same flavor. And I think in some places the Son of Frankenstein score serves its purpose here really well. Some places it's more like, well, they took a piece of Son of Frankenstein, stick it here, but okay. Yeah. That's what it is. And then there does sound to be a little, I don't know if it's original music or if I think some of Salter's music does still exist in bits and pieces here, because there's definitely some original stuff here and there, but yeah. Meanwhile, during this whole battle, John Wyatt has been, he was going to be put in the Tower of London. Elizabeth gets mad at Henry, or at Edward for doing this, and Edward agrees to send him off to France to be with
was it Henry Tudor?
The other guy. Henry Tudor, yes, thank you. To be with Henry Tudor. Henry Tudor, again, is another part of the family, and Henry Tudor is in France. He's exiled, and he's planning on coming back and taking the throne back, but he has no money to raise an army with the French. So he's basically trying to raise an army and have French people help him come and take back the throne. And his name's Henry Tudor, and we see what's going to happen is this will end the Plantagenet line of the kings and begin the Tudor line, which, as we know, goes on with King Henry VIII. I think Henry becomes Henry the somethings after this. Anyway,
the Tudor line isn't much better, to be honest.
Yeah, no, exactly. No, they're all kind of schmoes. But Alice, there's a great scene I skipped over. Alice tries to get a little message to John before he leaves.
Oh,
and
yeah.
There's a plan to get him, like, whatever, like that. And she gives to this little messenger boy, and the messenger boy runs to the garden and
he's killed.
Boris Karloff grabs him and finds him and just kills this kid, this messenger boy. He could have just intercepted the message, but he steps on the kid's back and basically just breaks his back. So, yeah, there's Mord for us. I mean, it's really like three little kids die in this movie. And they don't die. They're cold-bloodedly murdered.
In a way,
it's like as gruesome as it gets. It's funny.
It is. And you don't
I mean, it's
see,
not funny. It's sad.
I mean,
you know what I mean?
I guess the exception of like maybe Frankenstein, or, you know, there's a girl that was attacked in Dracula.
Right.
You don't really see this. You certainly don't see to this level in much of the Universal Horrors at all. There's a little boy and son of Dracula who's bitten, but I mean, they kind of survive. You just don't see a kid just mercilessly killed.
Right. You also don't see old men while they're praying get
stabbed in the back.
We don't really see it here. We sort of have the implication, but yeah. So the problem is old King Henry survives the battle and they're like, what are we going to do about this? And Richard's like, well, I'm pretty sure, you know, natural causes are going to take care of him. And unnatural causes take care of him very soon. He goes to pray. He's talking to Richard. He goes to pray and Richard, knifes him. And the, obviously someone comes right up to the king's like, oh, he died of natural causes or the wounds of his battle or, you know, whatever. They make up a story very quickly about.
And you can tell that Edward knows, you know?
Yes, of course. Yeah. They're saving the king from knowing what the dark deeds of his brother. He kills Edward while he's praying. He doesn't do it. He gives it to Mort, right? Yeah. Mort, but he gives him this dagger in the shape of a cross. And there's this idea that like,
he'll be blessed
these two believe they're on some kind of holy mission. Yeah. Like they found a way to absolve themselves of the guilt of what they're doing. They're killing children and old men. And it's this idea of like that this serves a higher purpose or this, you know, I don't know. It's interesting. And I think if you'd had a scene in Frankenstein where the Frankenstein monster like stabs a little kid or like an old man, you know, I think they would have had a lot of problems even in Frankenstein, but especially at this point during the Breen Office era, with censorship. But I get the feeling part of the whole allure of doing this period epic based on history was the fact that if something was going to be censored, they can say this is based on the historical fact. You know what I mean? They have kind of an out there, I think. I don't know if they ran into censorship problems and I don't know if they ever had to justify it that way, but it does seem like they had a little bit more leeway to get away with stuff with the idea that this is all historical.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Historical drama. Hey, it happened in real life. We can't control it. We didn't make this up, you know.
we're just telling the thing, yeah. Richard one by one is plucking the Paper Crown King and Prince of Wales, the dolls off of his little kill menagerie. to be killed and throwing them in the fire and letting them burn and stuff. So there's this idea of like these dolls scorching, turning black in the fire, which is just a beautiful thing. You know, he's burning his way to the crown. So Edward or no, Wales's wife, Anne, who is the woman Richard loves, somehow is missing and they can't find her in the wake of her husband being killed. And it's this one moment where we see Richard kind of turn on Mord and he basically threatens him. He's like, your head will be next if you don't find her. Like Mord worships Richard and Richard is affectionate to him. And I think he obviously serves his purpose, but it's not unconditional. Like their friendship, like Mord serves him at his pleasure. And if, you know, he doesn't really please him, then there's a good chance that Mord could find himself, you know, on the block as well. It's not, you know, Richard doesn't have favorites like this, except for Anne. So Mord does find her finally. She's hiding with like a family or something, brings her back. Richard again, you know, weirdly loves her, and he convinces the king, now that her husband's dead, he convinces the king to let them be married. And and gets her to kind of agree. He makes it seem like he's the one arguing for her. He makes it seem like Edward wants to kill Anne, or to have Anne executed, and Richard's the only one standing up for her.
Yeah, makes and, himself and look he makes like it, a hero.
Yeah, yeah. Meanwhile, he again, he's behind the whole thing. This is all a wink, wink thing between him and Edward. But it does make Anne think that, you know, look, this guy's kind of capable of doing bad things, but he's always been good to me. So, you know, whatever, I'll marry. But I think it's a calculated thing too. Like, I think she's like, yeah, I'll marry him. I mean, if it's just between that and being executed, I guess she's like, I guess I'll marry Richard.
But, yeah. guess I'll do
she
it.
She falls out of the story at this point. I think her character's more, has more going on in the Shakespeare play, but after this, Anne kind of they get married, and then she kind of disappears. We don't see Richard and her kind of, you know. And in the play, he basically says I'm gonna get what I need out of her and toss her aside, which I think in the play the implication is that he's gonna have a child with her,
yeah,
to secure his succession and whatever, which doesn't happen. Richard never had historically Richard never had children, so when he died without an heir, obviously.
And Anne is played by Rose Hobart.
Yes. What do we know Rose Hobart from?
Well, I know her from The Mad Ghoul, and she was also in...
Oh.
I'm going to miss... And this is... I'm blanking on this. She's in an earlier 30s horror movie. Jekyll and Hyde, what you just talked about.
Oh. Jekyll and Hyde. That's right. She's Muriel. She's Henry Jekyll's paramour. Okay, great. Yeah, I didn't. It's funny to recognize her because it's hard because even Nan Gray is a little hard to recognize in this because you never see their hair. They're constantly wearing these
exactly.
towel things. They're in the period and stuff like that. So without kind of being able to see Nan Gray's hair, it's kind of like it's weird. Like the only time I really realize it's Nan Gray is when she disguises herself as the chimney sweep boy. And then you see just her face, and you're like, oh, yeah, it's definitely Nan Gray in all her glory. In some sort of plot to whatever, we have the scene that was Universal's least favorite scene in the movie where Edward decides to marry these two children who are like 7 and 6 years old, which is, again, not historically too fantastic. That kind of thing happened. And it happened. I mean, children were married to adults. It was not uncommon. And it was a way that again, families, not just royal families, but like noble families, coalesced their power and created alliances between them that made them stronger and more resilient. But here's where little Donnie Dunnigan, shows up and is marrying the little girl, and she tries to give him a flower and he's like, no, thanks. Which is, I think, fun. But then she drops it and he helps pick it up, and you know, he's adorable. He doesn't have a whole lot to do. Clarence, Vincent Price's character, is sort of wondering with his wife Isabel, like, you know, at the silliness of this and the, you know, how calculated it is. And he's sort of wondering if it's Richard's plan or whatever, and then without any, and he's worried about Anne because Anne somehow related to him. Like somehow his marriage got him all these properties and made him very wealthy, him personally, not, you know, aside from the family. And Anne is connected to those properties. And then when he finds out that Anne and Richard are married, this creates a conflict because now technically Richard has a claim on some of these very valuable properties, counties or what have you, that Clarence own. So the fun thing that this results in is now we have kind of a conflict between Basil Rathbone and Vincent Price.
Yes.
Which is way more interesting than the political intrigue that leads to it or justifies it or what have you. It's, you know, and there's a scene where King Edward, you know, Vincent Price has played Clarence up to this point as kind of a dolt, kind of a wimp, kind of effeminate, whiny. He's not the soldier that Richard is in any way, shape, or form. He's a bureaucrat practically. He's much softer. And he plays him kind of fey, kind of lighter. But there's this moment when the king declares that it's just the three of them are in the room, and he declares that Richard's going to get some of Clarence's properties, and the really valuable ones. And Vincent Price, did you see this? Like, there's this moment where Vincent Price, the whole Clarence thing drops, and he gets sinister. He gets dark. And he gets kind of dangerous and kind of, you know, not physically, but like you can see like there's a turn, and we see like, you know, it's a very young, I don't know what, is he 28 or 30 at this point, Vincent Price?
He'd be 28 because he's born in 1911. And this was 39.
Go me. So,
yeah. Good job.
Awesome. Right. So, now, what was your meeting about this afternoon?
Vincent Lydia. Price was 28 years old in 1939. Yeah,
exactly. But we get to see it for the first time, I think, in a Universal film, like really like the sinister side of Vincent Price could do, like when he could play threatening and stuff like that. And it's great to see.
Because he has that great line there as he's like leaving. He's like, "You'll be sorry, Richard. You'll be sorry."
Yes. You'll be sorry. Yes. It's so great. And so this is kind of a plan by Richard and by Edward. They're both, I don't know how to say it, like they kind of don't like their brother, and they're sort of teaming up against him, and they're setting him up a little bit here too. They know that Clarence's next step is going to be to start kind of recruiting parts of the royalty and nobility to his side. Because he feels like he's getting pushed aside, and he kind of sees the writing on the wall, and he starts thinking like, "Hey, I need to start looking after myself if anything's gonna work out." And they're in a tavern doing this, and I don't know. Do you know who the actor is who plays the bar guy, who then comes up and tells Mord? He's this little guy, and he seems to have some sort of speech issue.
I don't know if he's
actually like a person of small stature or what. He's got like a puffed out chest. I'm not sure what his deal is. I'd love to find out who he is. I looked through the credits. I looked through everything. And I couldn't find out. I don't think he's credited. And I know I've seen him in other stuff, possibly other Universal stuff. And I just don't know. I don't think he was in Todd Browning's Freaks, but there's a possibility he might've been in Todd Browning's Freaks. I don't know. Anyway, Clarence is conniving at the tavern, the tavern, you know, whatever bartender guy or whatever server guy warns Mord. So this is going to get back to Richard now that Clarence is whatever. Meanwhile, Mord is letting someone out of he's sealing someone up in an Iron Maiden as he's talking. So they're having a whole conversation. And you realize there's some dude inside this thing getting like all these spikes driven into his body, and he opens it up and the guy's like, "Oh," he just falls back.
Again, normal anyway. Wednesday.
Yeah, no, exactly. All right. It's the disdain that Karloff gives Mord, where it's just like, this is just his job. He's like, "Oh, hang on, it's like you gotta fill the Xerox machine with paper, right?" It's just like, "Oh, you know, hang on, I gotta get this guy out of the Iron Maiden, I'll be right with you."
We should redo Tower of London, but in like an office style work comedy setting, you know?
Yeah,
like
exactly.
And, you know, the Tower of London. So
there's just one
the crow
one
on this.
Yeah, everyone these vicious copy machine accidents where someone's like legs are sticking out of the machine. Yeah. This leads to Clarence getting arrested Mort shows up and arrests him in the name of the king for conspiring against the king. Clarence is thrown into the Tower of London and imprisoned. Richard visits him. And again, he's doing this thing where he's pretending to be on his side. Richard's constantly doing this. Richard loves not letting anyone know that he's the one sticking the knife in their back, right? Yeah. It's his way of, I think, maybe keeping his options open. I don't know. Clarence is convinced though that he's not on his side, that he's rightly so. Mord comes in and brings some wine. And Clarence is convinced that Richard's trying to poison him when he pours him a drink, and then Richard drinks it all himself and proves that he wasn't. And this leads to my favorite scene in the movie where Vincent Price challenges Richard, Basil Rathbone to a basically a duel for the lands and the properties that they share, and it's kind of like winner take all, and Richard accepts, and obviously he's so much more superior a fighter than Clarence. Clarence wouldn't have a chance. So Richard's like, I'll do anything. I'll fight you with anything. I'll beat you with anything. Sword, stick, club, whatever. I'll even, wine or whatever. And that's the moment Clarence goes, wait, hang on. You said wine. Cause Clarence is a wine bibber. Clarence is a big drinker, and we've set it up ahead of time where his wife is like, you've had enough to drink. Let's go do this. Clarence likes his wine, and obviously the cellars of the castle are full with wine and stuff. So, Clarence accepts his challenge and says, I will duel you with wine. So they're going to have a drinking competition, basically, of rich, heady Malmsey, they say, which Malmsey is like a kind of a sweet variety of wine, which I looked it up. It's more from like the Mediterranean, like Greece and stuff, apparently. So that's all I know. It's called something else now. So we have this scene where Basil Rathbone and Vincent Price are having a drinking competition in these ridiculous period wigs, right?
And tights
in the basement of a thing, and tights and everything like that. And it's not like we see the beginning of it. We come into the next scene where they're downstairs in the basement having their drink competition. We come in like halfway through it, so they're both already shellacked, and it's just so much fun. And Richard is just sweating and greasy, and just he looks really bad.
The scene is really well done. And if there's ever a reason to get the Blu-ray of Tower of London, it's this scene here, because like you see them drooling, you see the sweat coming off their face. It's messy, it's disgusting, but it fits exactly what they're doing.
It's really gross. They're like spitting it out, and they're just like, they just went for it. Apparently they filmed, Vince Price said they filmed this whole scene in one day, and a lot of it was ad-libbed, and they just kind of went for it. They're drinking out of these mugs that are the size of like a 1 liter of soda. And ironically, because apparently instead of wine, they were actually drinking Coca-Cola. Was what they used in the scene instead of wine, obviously, because you can't use wine because the actors are actually going to get inebriated and they're, you're in trouble now. it's also illegal now to do that. But so the actors weren't getting drunk, but they must have been getting kind of belchy, right? Because I can't imagine drinking an entire, like, he's drinking like a half gallon of Coca-Cola. That's just a lot of, I guess it was pretty flat by then, but yuck. That set must have been so sticky. They probably just had to like burn it down.
Burn it,
right? It would have been awful, right? Oh, yikes. So bad. No one was falling asleep though, I guess. It's all the caffeine. Before they start, there's a moment where Clarence doesn't trust him, and Richard swears, he crosses his heart. He's like, on my honor as a knight, Malmsey will be the only weapon used in this battle. And he's not lying.
No, because he's not.
at the end of the scene, when Clarence has honestly beat Richard and Richard's passed out for a few minutes, when he wakes up again, he comes at him and Ward's there, and they dump Clarence into an entire vat of wine and seal the lid and drown him in wine. So he didn't lie. Malmsey was the only weapon used.
Yeah.
Him. So because Richard, I think, takes his oath as a knight kind of seriously in his own way. He thinks he's a knight. He thinks he's on, again, like I said, like some sort of like noble cause. Like, I don't know if he thinks he's going to be the one to save England from itself by becoming the king. Like, no one else is doing the right job. I don't know. But it's what it is. But Price is so good in this scene. I just want to take a moment. He's laughing maniacally, like he's crazy. His face is distorted. He's really, they're going for, you really believe that they could be drunk. Like, you really, you really believe that the actor himself, you believe the character's drunk, but you believe the actor himself could have been drunk turning in this performance. Cause it's just a little unchoreographed and loose. It's again, like you said, he's drooling and stuff. It's really gross. It's fascinating.
It is.
It's a great scene.
It is.
Great scene.
It's a fantastic scene. And Rathbone's the complete opposite of Price in this one. He's quiet. Like his eyes are only half open. You know, he's got drool coming out of his mouth and is sweating like a pig. And, you know, you could tell like he's drunk and he is trying his hardest to still keep it together. And even at the, you know, at the end, he's like throwing the drink on his face and trying to get his bearings
afterwards he like throws a drink in his own face to wake himself up.
But the
look he gives Clarence when he wakes up from being passed out is so evil, and it's so Rathbone had this he had a very interesting nose. He had a very like this pronounced Roman aquiline nose thing, which obviously made him look so good. I mean, that's why we associate him with a silhouette of Sherlock Holmes. It's him in the Deerstalker, and it's that nose of his, right? Just an excellence. And I would say this and the scene in Raiders of the Lost Ark in the tavern in Nepal with Marion are my two favorite drinking scenes of any, and maybe Marion's scene with Belloc in Cairo as well, but way up there for drinking scenes in movies, man.
And like as far as like attention to detail, so this is kind of what I was talking about when I was praising Rathbone's performance in this movie earlier, is that when he, so after they, after Clarence passes out, so, you know, Richard passes out for a few minutes and then wakes back up, and then Clarence passes out, and that's when, you know, Richard throws the drink in his face and he like tries to get up. And the way that he gets up, you know, there's kind of two ways to play, I think anyways, like a drunk person. One is just kind of just for laughs and over the top, and it's just some guy falling all over the place. Yeah. But this is so accurate. Like you said, you believe that they could have been drinking because you could tell, like it looks like Richard thinks the whole room is spinning. He's like holding on to everything. He's moving slow.
The chair and everything. Yeah. He's moving slow.
it's such a
great
detail.
Someone told me once, or maybe I heard someone say once that the way to play drunk when you're an actor is to try not to be drunk. You're doing your best to try to convince everyone that you're not drunk.
A Foster Brooks, essentially.
So it just sells. So it sells the idea that. But it is. You're right. The way he gets up in that chair is so believable. You're like, yeah, I've been there. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
I see. I see it. Oh my. And again, the attendants come and tell the king, like, you know, Duke of Clarence died, you know, as a result of his
drinking,
and you know, and he's like, well, where's Richard? Richard's incapacitated, and Edward's like, well, he should learn a lesson from his brother, and he's like, all right, well, wake me up when it's morning.
He knows what happened.
Yeah. I'm just saying, there are a lot of mysterious deaths happening in this castle. That's no one's paying attention. We go to several years later. We kind of have a time jump. The kids are really babies and stuff. So it's like 7 years or 8 years maybe or something like that. It has a legend that says the year, but I wasn't keeping track of who, you know. By the way, my favorite thing is the king's sleeping and he's wearing his pajamas, and they have his royal crest on his pajamas too. So the king has his crest on his Jimmy Jams.
Well, naturally, it's really funny.
It's like it's monogrammed. Yeah. Years go by. John Wyatt is still in exile in France with Henry Tudor, and they're kind of talking about, you know how this is going to, about going back to England and about, you know, the hope they have for everything. The young boys who Edward's sons who are named Edward and Richard themselves, which again, here's where we get a little confusing, is there's Edward and Richard, the adults, and then the king's sons are Edward and Richard as well. They're older now and they're getting closer to, you know, not manhood, but, you know,
adolescence, I guess. Yeah.
Adolescence. Yeah. And Edward himself is dying, just of, I don't know, natural causes or being a crappy person or something. I'm not sure. You know, it is the Middle Ages. Like people just died natural at 40, and, right? 40 and, was a good,
like, you know, 14 or whatever the year is, you know? So basically, you know, like you said, reach the age of 35 and, you know,
yes.
Well, you've had a nice life. Just,
yeah. But you ate just too much mutton. So too bad. Here you go. maybe you should have washed your hands once in a while. Who knows?
Yeah.
Actually, apparently that's wrong. Apparently, people in the Middle Ages were quite hygienic. It was after the Middle Ages that people stopped like bathing a whole lot and stuff like that. But apparently, up until then, people were quite hygienic. I don't know. So Edward's ill. He dies, and Richard. The first thing he says is bring John Wyatt back from his exile and let him and Alice marry. He's trying to do right by maybe some of the things he felt he did that were you know misguided. But his other thing is that Richard is going to be the Lord Protector and watch over his son Edward who's now Edward the Fifth, and help guide him as he's king, because Edward the Fifth is 11 or 12 or something, you know, he's obviously not, you know, up for being king. So Richard the Third is going to be, you know, kind of the advisor to the king, and he's going to look after him. And of course, Elizabeth is terrified of that, because this means her older son is going to go live in the castle with his uncle, with Richard, and Richard's going to have this, you know, sway over him, which she knows is dangerous, because she knows Richard for what he is. Interestingly, in the real historical when young Edward was going to be king, the real historical Richard found a way to say that his brother Edward and Elizabeth's marriage was illegitimate. So young Edward would be a product of bigamy, and therefore was not. He got him like removed from succession, like he wasn't eligible for the crown because he was like an illegitimate son. He was declared that. I don't think that was the case, but Richard, the real historical Richard, managed to have that done. And the Richard and his younger brother were taken away to the Tower of London and were never heard from again. And so the idea is that this is based on a historical thing, and Richard really did kill his nephews in order to get them out of the way of the throne.
And I could be mistaken on this, but I do seem to recall that there was some question as to did he or did he not actually kill, you know, his nephews. And I think, and I forget when it was, but I think they actually found the bodies like buried under stairs or something.
Of
the nephews, which kind of confirmed like, oh no, they were killed.
They got killed. Or at the very least, maybe we're put in a situation where they didn't live very long, right? I mean, it wouldn't have been hard to put someone in a tower that's not heated during the winter and not feed them much and not give them any clothes, and eventually someone's going to die. You don't have to actually like murder someone straight out, like homicide style. Homicide style. So for the purposes of our film here, everybody, back to this. Richard does do this thing where he convinces the council that it'd be better if young Edward's younger brother, Richard the Third's namesake, came and stayed with him as well. And that way, like, maybe he'd be happier being king if he had his little brother there to keep him company, right? This gets back to Elizabeth, who now, following the death of her husband, is now, like, living in a convent with Alice, with her, you know, maid in waiting or whatever. And she's like, no way, not both my sons. Both my sons cannot go there under his sway. And she's basically, you know, she doesn't, as a woman in this era, she really doesn't have any rights. And technically her son, the king, has said, he sent a note saying, I want this to happen. And all his royal people are like, well, the king says he wants this. You don't really have the option. So it's going to happen one way or the other. So young Richard joins Edward the Younger, in the castle at this point. And then the other thing that's happening is Richard is working with Mord, and Mord has like the connection, like we've said before, to like the rabble, to like the peasants, and
controls the narrative of the town.
yes, exactly. So he's getting them to, you know, they're kind of practicing. He practices with them what they're going to say, and they're going to go around spreading the idea that like, no, we want Richard to be king. We don't want this young boy and stuff. So Richard's manipulating himself into the hearts of the people saying like, you know, it's the whole thing about, I won't say who coined the phrase, but you know, the bigger the lie, the more people believe it kind of thing. Yeah. It's that kind of thing. So they're basically trying to get populace on the side of the idea of Richard should be king, so that when they're going to do what they're going to do, there's not like some kind of public, you know, whatever terror. There's a great scene where young Edward is dueling with Richard. Like Richard's actually like teaching his son how to fight. And I don't have the name of this young actor who's playing young, you know, King Edward, but I don't know if they had him train for a while or if Rathbone trained him or what. Like there's a good fight scene where they're dueling with rapier and dagger in the ring here. And this kid is going at it with Basil Rathbone. Yeah. It's really great.
I don't know his name either, but you did remind me there is one bit of trivia that I missed mentioning at the very, very start. So at the start of the movie, when, is it De Vere that gets executed at the very start?
Yes.
I could be wrong. I thought that was actually Rathbone's son. Yeah.
Oh, playing De Vere?
Yeah, it is.
Is it really? Oh, wow.
So his name, his credited name is John Rodian or Rodian, but yes. His real name is Rodian Rathbone.
I had no idea.
Only child of Basil Rathbone.
Basil Rathbone. That's very fascinating. I don't know that much about Rathbone's marriages and stuff. Was he married more than once, I think?
I don't know.
I'm not sure. Yeah. This sword fight scene where the tunic he's wearing, you really do see his hunchback, which is kind of interesting. There's a lot of parts of the film where they don't emphasize it much, but here you see him. Whenever he's sword fighting, it's interesting. And it's like, it's almost like he somehow is, maybe this is just my interpretation, he somehow learned to use his unique physical issues in a way that makes him an even deadlier sword fighter or something like that. It's like somehow, you know, he's got extra thrust behind that or something. I don't know. That's just my own, like, whatever. But it's interesting. It definitely does not hold him up as a fighter. He's just as deadly as anybody could be. But I like the scene where the little brother comes in and gets the sword. He's like, I want to fight you too, you know, uncle. And he's like, all in good time.
So I've hopped on to IMDb here. So the boy, King Edward, okay, is played by a gentleman by the name of Ronald Sinclair. And he was both an actor and also an editor. And he worked on editing sound for movies such as Die Hard, Die Hard 2, Spaceballs, Commando. A lot of...
Get out of town.
Yeah, a lot of 80s action flicks. And then, obviously...
I'm like 2 degrees away from that guy.
Yeah.
So I worked with Vernon Wells, who was in Commando. So that's cool. Very cool. Good for him. So he's one of those guys who like kind of acted for a while and then kind of moved to a kind of behind the scenes in cinema, but kept going, which is neat.
Looks like he stopped
and all the way into like our childhood.
Yeah. It looks like he stopped acting around like 1942. So it was just like, mm-hmm, a lot of kind of similar type roles of, you know, Tower of London, Christmas Carol. You know, stuff like that.
Interesting. Good deal. Yeah. That kid could move. He had some skills. So we get into this part of the film, which, as far as I know, is an invention of the filmmakers and doesn't have a base in historical things. So John Wyatt comes back from, you know, from France and meets with the queen in the convent, and with Alice. And again, Henry Tudor is in France trying to raise an army. And I guess has been for the better part of a decade at this point. So, but needs money. So there's this part of the film that becomes this heist movie where it does become a little bit like Die Hard, where John Wyatt is going to rob the king's, coffers. Like he's going to take all the royal treasury. Rob the royal treasury, take all that money, get it to France and give it to Henry Tudor and have Henry Tudor basically use the king's money to raise an army to depose the king. And as far as I can have looked up, this doesn't seem to have any basis in, you know, any kind of historical thing, but it's an interesting, we're in the third act now and we got to figure out like, you know, how to keep this going here. Cause Richard has, at this point, killed everybody in his way to the crown, except for the two kids, and And actually, what happens is he similar to real life, he does basically just get them pushed to the side and put them in, lock them in the Tower of London, and assumes the throne.
Yeah.
Before he even kills them. The two boys are locked up there, and they're kind of like, "What's happening? Why are we? You know, everyone was being so nice to us, and now we seem to be locked in a tower. It's not very good.
So this whole sequence that's coming up, it's both my favorite part of the movie, but it's also the most heartbreaking. I think the way that they pulled it off, but the way they executed it was great, because they both recognized the ruthlessness and horror of murdering brutally two innocent kids, but also still doing it,
Yes.
And like you said, the boys are there talking and they're saying that stuff, well, Richard's not talking to us now. And, everyone used to be so nice to you and so nice to us. And now we get nothing and we're locked away. And, it really kind of brings in the fact of that, these are kids and they don't have a sense of necessarily, succession to the throne or the manipulators that are out there working against them.
The web they're caught in.
Exactly.
Yes, exactly. I missed John Wyatt is caught or is arrested and they found that he was the one who went into the castle at the right hour. So they know that he's the one who facilitated the robbing of the royal treasury. He's arrested and imprisoned in the Tower of London. And Richard comes and visits him and tries to get the truth out of him first before we get to the next stage. And Rathbone and Sutton have this scene together, and it's sort of charged sexually a little bit. I think there's a lot of like they're really up next to each other. Like Rathbone's really close in his face, and their bodies are close and stuff. And there's John Wyatt's character's chained up and everything. And there's just this hint of something there that's like very just edgy, and it's an interesting kind of scene of like, I don't know, it's like how close like passion and hatred and affection and everything are, can be kind of. And I just think it's done. I don't know if it was even overtly intended or if it was wanted to be subtlety or whatever. I'm not making speculations, but I'm just saying like my perspective on it, it just serves to make that scene just a little more dangerous. There's something feral and hungry in Richard's attitude that's just very that you wouldn't want to be John Wyatt in that scene is all I'm going to say. And then it goes right into Wyatt being whipped and chained up and tortured and Richard watching with a certain amount of satisfaction. So
he was hung up by his thumbs.
I know.
Just left there, and that just sounds terrible.
Yikes. Yeah, yeah. And then like he's there's a hot poker like shoved in his back and stuff. So he's really like abused and beaten and stuff like that. And Richard's, it's this thing where Richard's trying to find an answer to where the treasure is, but you also get the feeling that he's sort of just enjoying watching be tortured as well. That alone is sort of enough for him. So, again, I think the nice thing about something like this is like anyone can bring their own perspective to it, no one's wrong. It's just what you're getting out of it is based on your own context and it can be what you need it to be. It's a great sequence of them torturing him, and it's gruesome without actually showing anything really gross or gruesome, obviously, because they were restrained by, the morals and, restrictions of the time. Alice knows that Wyatt is being tortured, and she's trying to figure out a way to get to him and whatever. And so she's begging the priest. She's trying to figure out a way. And obviously the idea is if she goes and gets caught, then she's going to be in quite a lot of trouble too. And Richard probably wouldn't hesitate to execute a woman, even the queen says, which I believe she's right. So they come up with this ingenious thing where she's going to dress as a chimney sweep's assistant, like basically the little boy that fell down the chimney earlier, she's going to dress up like him because she's a smaller physical person. And Tom Klink is going to sneak her in the thing. So Tom Klink, again, this is what we were talking about, Olivia. Like, Tom Klink emerges as, like, in this one sequence, he suddenly becomes, like, one of the heroes of this revolution.
And very effective,
very quietly
one too.
Brave.
Yeah.
He's very clever. He's very, you know, because the guards are like, oh, you can't come in. The tower's closed right now. And Tom Klink's like, well, if you want, you know, soot falling on the king, then, you know, by all means, I'll tell him you're the one who said that I couldn't come in. And they're like, well, okay, well, you better let him in. He's very brave. Like, he doesn't do any physical fighting, but he's very brave, and, like, he's taking a lot of risk to affect this thing. And I don't know if he's doing it out of loyalty to any one person or whatever, or if that he's just hurt by the idea of someone being hurt. You know what I mean? They don't really get into his motivation.
I thought about this, and you know, if he's obviously he's been a chimney sweep for some time. He's an older man, and I would assume that he's been servicing the castle there for quite a while, and he's probably heard and witnessed and been privy to some information that the general townspeople don't. And he probably realizes after all these years that, you know, Richard's a dick and all these people are dying, and, you know.
Richard's a dick is ironic.
I didn't even realize that. That's
I like that. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, you know, maybe, like, he's just had enough, maybe, of all the hurt and all the whatever. I don't know. He just comes off as such a decent man, I thought he was, you know, it's funny. I always think he's the guy in Captain Blood, the actor who played him. Honesty, whatever his name is, who helps them escape from the plantation in Captain Blood and become pirates, but it's a different actor, and I don't know. And from other stuff, but this is where we get Nan Gray in drag, basically, as the chimney sweep, and her face is all dirty and everything. She's wearing the tights and stuff, and there's a funny moment where they walk in, they finally do let him in, and the one guard's like, you know, hurry up there, and he whacks her on the butt, which is funny since she's basically like the queen's attendant. She's really not someone that you do that to. So this lowly guard just thinks he's gonna like take. take a moment. So
he slaps are good too. I think that that extra playing the guard got his pay's worth that day.
You think he was committed? He was committed. The scene. I think so. I agree. But you know, here what I like about it is, you know, it's not just about men fighting battles and swords and shields and stuff. You know, it's the quiet bravery of someone like Tom Klink and the very risk that. Dangerous risk that Alice is taking in trying to get to John, to, you know, her lover. She gets down the chimney, she sees John, they have a nice little they're reunited. And he tells her where the treasure is hidden, and she slips him these two files that he's going to use to saw through the chains that hold him. And if you've ever used a file on any bit of metal, the idea that you see the width of those links, like, I feel like it could have been like 1720 and he still would have been filing those things. That would take a lot of work.
Yeah.
But okay. You know, maybe they're old chains. Nan Gray's great in this. Nan Gray's always great. And again, like I said, like, Nan Gray has emerged in the doing of the podcast. Nan Gray's emerged as one of my top three Universal leading women. She's lovely, and there's so much vulnerability in her eyes, and she just, her style performance is so contemporary. It's so invested. It never feels too arch. It's really, she's wonderful.
No. And you know, you see her here in three kind of really different roles. I don't say unique, but just very differing roles. So, you know, Dracula's daughter in the kind of the form of lower class, you know, girl just trying to get a warm place to stay and food, and who's seduced by another woman. And then, you know, The Invisible Man Returns as a faithful, somewhat naive, wife of Vincent Price, but also very strong in resisting, you know, Sir Cedric Hardwicke's advances in that movie and all that. And then here, she's just straight, you know, heroics, you know, all the way. She loves this man, and she will stop at nothing to help him and to be with him. So she was, I think she's a very, very much an unsung hero out of
I was just going to say that she was unsung. I was just going to use that phrase. You're so right. So I'm really glad I've rediscovered her kind of as, you know, one of my favorite leading ladies from this era. She's a killer. John escapes by means of a rope, and a guard, tries to stop him, and he punches him from about an inch and a half away on the chin and knocks the guard out. And it's not the most convincing fight choreography in the film, but okay. I'm just not sure how like athletic John Sutton actually was. You know, who knows? But he escapes, and there's a great scene where he gets out of the tower, but then he's got to get out through the portcullis, which is like the gate that goes up and down, through the moat that surrounds the tower, because the tower is surrounded by a moat to help keep people from escaping, obviously. And he does it by someone's leaving in this very fancy, you know, rowboat thing, and he kind of grabs onto the end of it. And there's just a great moment. I remember when I first saw this movie thinking like, ooh, that's just it's so subtle how he's holding on to the back of the boat, and you see the gate coming down behind the boat, and they're lowering it very close to the back of the boat. So, and it's got spikes on the bottom. You're just like, oh my God, his legs are like very close. Like even watching it now, I'm sure it's a stunt guy doing it, but you're like, oh, that just seems like that was close.
That would hurt. Yeah.
Yeah. Those things would just go through right to the back of your calves, right? How heavy is that gate? Tom Klink is waiting with his little canoe type thing tied up, and he's fishing for eels. And there's this whole thing where like the guard's like, which I love, the guard's like, you can't fish here, or you can't catch fish here. And he's like, well, I'm actually trying to catch eels, which are technically not fish. They're more like snakes. So does that really count? Like he's arguing the particulars of the,
like he was just caught without his fishing license or something.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Like he's arguing the minutia of the law. But he's like, okay, I'll leave soon and stuff like that. But luckily then John Sutton managed to swim up and Tom Klink serves his final bit of, you know, help to the revolution. He gets John Sutton freed into a ship that's gonna sail to France or Wales or whatever, wherever Henry Tudor's army is gathering. This is the point, we kind of jumped ahead. This is the point where they realize Sutton's escaped, the treasure's gone, and the queen's kind of behind it. And Richard, in this one moment, he's raging, and then he gets very quiet. And you see he realizes what he can do to just destroy the queen's will. And this is
where
he makes the decision to have his nephews murdered. And what I love is, like, Mord even, he turns and he's like, wait.
It's the only time talking about, Mord hesitates.
They don't say it. Yeah, well, yeah, he hesitates. And then there's this scene where with the kids where I want to talk just a minute about how Karloff plays this, because, and the film plays it too. The film takes a minute with this, and it gives it the weight. And it's not just like, oh, the kid looks up, he's like, what are you doing? And someone like rushes in. There's a moment where the boys both fall asleep, and the younger one, Richard, falls asleep praying for strength while his brother sleeps. Mord comes in the room, and the first thing he does is he actually picks up young Richard and puts him in the bed too, and covers him up with a blanket, like he tucks him in. And there's a moment where you see this conflict, right?
Yeah, because he picks him up, and when he picks him up, Richard kind of instinctively puts his arm around Mord's Mord's neck, and it just I think it catches Mord off guard, and this is by far Karloff's best moment in the movie, because he kind of gives a slow look down, and you just see the. This is the one thing that bothers him, and you can tell the weight of it. And
right.
He said, you know, he gently puts him back down and then kind of tucks him in. And he even has this half look of disgust when he measures the body, you know.
And he's basically measuring the body for a grave. They're digging a hole in the bottom of the tower, and he literally is like, okay, he's about this tall. And then he comes down, and he's like, about this. But I just, you know, I like Roland V. Lee, like, takes a minute and shows the conflict of someone. He shows this character getting ready to cross a line that maybe he didn't even think he would cross. You know, maybe it's like what's his name in Leon the Professional. He's like, no women, no kids. Like, you know, he's got a code, right? I always talk about codes with characters. it's the one thing that even more kind of has to question, like, am I someone who can do this, just out of loyalty to my king? And this is why, frankly, this is why you hire Boris Karloff for a role like this, right? I mean, not only because of his physical ability and his look and the menace he brings and everything like that, but again, it's that moment where you see just a crack of humanity inside this character who has Mord ever known affection? Has anyone, were his parents nice to him? Was he abandoned? Did he grow up an orphan? Did he, you know, what does he owe Richard that somehow this guy with a club foot has managed to survive in this era where, you know, that's easily was something that would have led to an early death in you. Yeah, it's just a moment. And it's just a moment where, like, Universal got their money's worth out of Karloff just for that one scene alone, right?
Absolutely.
It's just, it's a good moment.
And I think Harry Cording has an equally good moment here.
Yeah.
You know, he measures the body, comes down, and then he comes back with, I think, three guys.
With the gang, yeah.
And Harry Cording's there front and center, kind of looking at the camera, and they're just standing there. And, you know, Karloff's like, all right, go do it. And
do it. Yeah, and he makes his underlings do it. He doesn't do it. Yeah. And he won't get his hands this dirty. It's interesting.
And they just, I mean, you see the look on Harry Cording's face, and he's like heartbroken. He's like, I don't want to do this. It's like, this is terrible. It's like, yeah. they are literally hating what they're about to do. And of course, what happens, the boys wake up and, excuse me, and says, you know, well, what's going on? What are you doing? No. And then they have to rush in.
And they figure out what's going to happen. Yeah. They've come to kill us. Yeah. They know it. And they scream, which is, there's the scream that's terrifying, that is, you know, that got past the sensors and everything. I mean, the implications is tough.
Well,
I think the other thing they had going for, like,
little kid scream. It's a very high pitched, you know, right. It is terror. Yeah. It's unsettling.
Yeah, terror. Yeah. Yes. And this holds true, I believe, with the play as well. I think Richard himself does not kill the kids in the play. I believe he hires two assassins, and they're kind of afraid, and they're bumbling a little bit. And there's a whole bit where they're talking before they decide to go in and murder these two kids, and they're trying to decide who's going to do it and who's not, and who's, you know. And it, I guess, it kind of takes a little bit of the grimness out of that, what that scene's about in the play. And and I think that's the thing that this film does with Karloff's performance. And even, and you said, Harry Cording, like, too, like that moment of hesitation where he's like, and then, you know, then they decided to do it. Harry Cording, who we know best, obviously, as the henchman in Black Cat, as Lugosi's, you know,
Tamal,
second in command there. So they kill the young king and the prince, and on the heels of this, Henry Tudor is, oh, and there's a great moment where once it's done, Elizabeth just wakes up in the middle of the night and just,
yeah, she knows.
Like, from miles away, she wakes up and she knows. Richard is finally, you know, his little doll, he puts him on the throne. Richard is king now. He's got everything he wants, and this is in keeping with the play as well. And in real life, like, Richard III was only king for 2 years, because what happens is, you know, in, at least in the film, John Wyatt has successfully gone to France with the treasure, which is going to fund Henry Tudor's army. Now, Henry Tudor's going to raise an army, mostly of, I think, French soldiers at this point, and lead them. They're going to go through Wales, and they're going to come in and try and depose Richard. There's a great scene here with Rathbone, where he's sitting there, and, you know, he got everything he wanted. He wanted to be king, and he's king, and he's sitting there with his little bell and a dagger, and he's dinging on it, and he knows Tudor's coming. And he knows the battle's, you know, on its way, and he's not afraid of the battle, but there's this feeling of like he got everything he wants and he's still not satisfied, right?
Yeah.
Like, maybe he thought that's what would do it, and he realizes it's not. He's still, you know, and he also, I think, realizes that there's a ticking clock. This is where Mord is just going, like, can I please come in the battle this time? Because he didn't get to go in the first battle, the Tewkesbury. He's like, I want to go in this battle. Like, he's like a little kid. He's like, please let me, yeah. And Richard says, I think I'm going to need all the friends I got in this battle. In the play, most of Richard's army deserts him, actually, in the Battle of Bosworth. That doesn't happen in this, but there's this implication, though, that, yeah, he's like, I need all the friends I can got. So we have sort of the end of the movie takes place in this big battle in Bosworth, which was filmed up in Sherwood Forest in Tarzana, which is where I think it's a lot of where they shot Robin Hood, Adventure Robin Hood, a year earlier, which is constantly a battle because Tarzana does not look like England. even in the good time of year, I've been in Tarzana. I know it's warmer now than it was in 1939. And so the climate's changed here a little bit, but it takes work, but it's as close as you're going to get in the LA area to something that looks vaguely like England, but you still have to dress it a lot. You have to like hang a lot of extra leaves and things on the trees and things, and you have to cover up a lot of things that don't look as naturally, you know, whatever. But there was this little bridge that they got to use that, you know, that sells as a thing. So this is the one that takes place in the fog, and they had trouble with the wind and the fog, and it would just blow and cover the lens and stuff. What I think ends up being a really successful battle, because I don't think they were able to really get a lot of the really wide shots to work. And I think that might have to do with some of the how well the costumes came out. I think it has to do with, they're filming, it's also the light. They're trying to film in California with this brilliant, amazingly hot sun. And they're trying to sell it as like this kind of moody atmospheric, you know, kind of thing. So I think all you can do is blast it with a lot of fog or hit them with rain. And sometimes even in the first battle, I think they superimpose rain in front of the, like in post, in front of the screen. And then for this one, the way I think Roland V. Lee ends up being able to tell the story is he tells it, every once in a while he shows the bigger battle, but he mostly shows these little skirmishes, these little one-on-one fights. He keeps cutting back and forth, which is a way like Peter Jackson did the Two Towers fight. Like it's a way to keep your heroes, and this is kind of basic filmmaking, obviously, but like it's a way like you follow the battle by showing your heroes and what's happening with them every couple frames, and then you know you go back and you show some other guys battling and stuff. But Roland V. Lee tells it with depth. He uses some rear screen projection and I think there's some reshoots of people fighting in the foreground, and then but he also the battle's just madness. It's just chaos. And Mord is just wandering. He's got this big mace, this big heavy hammer mace thing. And he's just wandering around bashing at people.
Yeah.
No one's really fighting him. He's just going off and picking people off. And Mord is having his best day ever. If this is going to be his last day of his life, then he went out okay. Because he was really, Mord is having a lot of fun just clubbing people to death on the battlefield. Just in keeping with his character, it's great. You know, he's in armor now. It's the first time we see him in anything except his executioner stuff. He's all in mail and everything, and he's got this like just demonic looking face with the prosthetic nose and the eyebrows and everything.
And he's smiling most of the time as he's killing all these people.
That's what I'm saying. He's having the best time. They do a good job. They have John Wyatt and Henry Tudor are both wearing kind of white metal masks, so we're usually very able to keep them clear and like where you know whatever they're doing. Some great stunt stuff, some actual gory stuff. You see some guys, their faces slashed open.
Yeah.
It's kind of a great scene where a guy jumps over a horse and stabs a dude and stuff. It's honestly pretty grisly, but like I said, it also shows like it's not a clean battle. It's a really ugly, chaotic battle. It's like a brawl between these two armies. It's not super choreographed. It's not super clean. It's not elegant. It's just nasty. And I think to some degree that serves the historical, you know, accuracy a little bit in just what a mess it was, and whether that's, you know, that's somewhat artistic in creation. That's somewhat just the reality of trying to get this thing shot, I think, in given the conditions again with the armor and everything like that, but it's dynamic. It's great. I love it, man. And there's in Mort's just bashing people around. It's fun. So what happens? So Henry Tudor finally sees Richard.
Yeah, they spot each other.
And and they spot each other across the battlefield, brings their visors. Oh, here you are. And they go in for a duel, and it doesn't last too long.
No,
and
it's
Henry
Tudor
kills Richard.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's the one thing in me. Well, one of the only things for the film for me is like, I feel like this could have been a little more epic. I don't know. Like it doesn't have to be Errol Flynn and Rathbone's duel at the end of Adventures of Robin Hood, because that's not what this movie is. It's not a swashbuckling movie. But it does seem like Richard goes down pretty fast, and that does seem to go against this legend we've created that he's so devastating on the battlefield. So I don't know. Like his first duel with Wales in the first battle is actually way longer and more interesting.
It is,
and intricate.
Yeah. It makes it wonder that if they had maybe shown Rathbone in battle longer, just with other people, like maybe he was fatigued.
One thing I was thinking, just like cutting a swath through like the other soldiers and stuff. Yeah. And they show that a little bit, but you don't really quite get the idea. But maybe it's just this idea of like, you know, in the play, of course, Richard's on a horseback and he's unhorsed, and he has the famous line where he's like, my horse, a kingdom for a horse, you know? Because the one thing, if you were a noble person, you did not ever get on the ground in a battle like this. You stayed on horseback because you were relatively safe. And higher up, you had the advantage. Once you got down on the ground, you were kind of in trouble. You're in the melee. So Richard's death does come pretty fast. And maybe it's not as satisfying as it could be, but, that's kind of mitigated by how satisfying Mort's death is. So John Wyatt, once Mort sees Richard killed, Mort actually tries to run away, and Wyatt chases him through the woods, and they have kind of this duel, which again is an elegant, which is kind of just a, yeah, they're, it's like a street fight.
Yeah, it is. It's not,
they're just going
sloppy
at it. Yeah. Yeah. And you get the feeling like Mort, this is where Mort's clubfoot really does work against him, where he's actually trying to escape. And obviously it's harder for him to do given his limitations than it otherwise would be. So he's not really making any kind of getaway. Wyatt keeps, he kind of keeps fending off Wyatt, and Wyatt keeps coming at him. And they finally end up, I love this scene where they end up like by the side of this really steep ravine, and they have this one kind of final fight, and Mort kind of loses his balance, and Wyatt manages to run him through with the sword, and Mort just falls down the thing. And it reminds me of, Livia, when the Invisible Man in the original, when Claude Rains puts the guy in the car shoves it down the thing and catches on fire, and you hear the guy screaming the whole way. Yeah. Yeah, it's kind of like that. He screams as he falls. It's great.
Yeah, no, it's good. It's Karloff has a little better of a send off here than Rathbone does.
Exactly.
It's a much smaller character, but it's fitting. I mean, he did get to enjoy his time on the battlefield, killing in warm blood, as he says. But you know, John Sutton or John Wyatt, you know, very deservedly
dispatches
him.
Yeah, yeah. And then we have this final great scene where,
bodies drag.
They drag, Richard's body. They strap him to two things and just drag him from a horse. And really, that's really Rathbone, like kind of
spitting
like,
on him, you know, as he's
they're spitting on him and calling him baby killer and stuff. It's great. I mean, it's so satisfying. You're like, okay, good. Like, you know, and you know, to some degree you have a little bit of accuracy there where again, like the real Richard III was taken away and just buried without ceremony. He was just like dumped in a grave.
Yeah.
For, you know, he was, and then we have just this little, you know, resolution here where John and Alice are finally married and the queen is there, you know, loving him. And a little bit before this, she has talked about how, you know, nothing's going to bring back her sons, but her daughters are safe. So she has the king also had, cause they see her in the you see her in the first scene, you see, Elizabeth is brushing her little girl's hair.
Yeah.
You see the babies, but she's brushing the little girl's hair that has tangles in. We kind of skip past that, but you know. So her daughter, at least there's at least one, but I think she says plural daughters, are safe. So she does have children that are going to live on, even though she has lost her two precious boys. But there's this idea that, you know, yeah, okay, things are going to go on. And Henry Tudor is going to become king. Whatever, Edward II or something like that, I think. I could be wrong about that. But you know, the Plantagenet line that that Richard III is part of in the movie, and it dies in real life. So yeah. That's it. That's Tower of London.
And so, you know, this, I mean, I think most of us that love these old Universal horror movies discovered these at a very young age. I know one of the, you know, the first movies I ever remember watching were these movies. And, you know, as I got older, which was in the 90s, you know, around the time they were coming out in the classic collection VHSs, or the, what was it that, I think it was David that called them the Silver Topped.
The Silver Top series. Yes. I'm using that from now on. That's brilliant. Yeah. I've never heard that.
So, you know, the one that came out with Tower of London's got this great shot of Karloff as Mord and all
Karloff on the cover. I'm staring at it right now.
And, I remember seeing it in a video store, a rental, and I was probably 8, 10, you know, so this was a long time ago, but, I watched it, and it was just, it seemed to me like it was the longest movie in the world, just because you know, it didn't really hold my interest as a kid, yeah. You know, wanting more of monsters and things like that. But as I got older, you know, it is really, really fun to watch, and it moves pretty fast. It's got some great scenes. Rathbone is freaking fantastic in this. So is Vincent Price. So is Karloff. And, you know, I think it's really, really well done. And as far as I want to say that, I think I heard this on the commentary on the Blu-ray. And anyone listening can please correct me if I'm wrong in this, but I think this is one of the more historically accurate, you know, depictions of Richard III's kind of life or this era, as opposed to some of the other, I guess, dramatizations of it, which I always thought was pretty nice that, you know.
Ironic.
Yeah.
Considering it's Universal, which is not exactly known for being super faithful to the source material.
Exactly.
Whether it's Frankenstein, Dracula, Black Cat, yeah. Raven. Yeah. I mean, I would say this and maybe Murders in the Rue Morgue, because at least that one's pretty, you know, the main core of it delves pretty close to like the source material. But yeah, no, exactly. I definitely think it's super accurate. It might be more accurate than the play to some degree in some ways.
Yeah.
Not in others, obviously, but yeah, no, it's, and I think they do a great, like, with the exception maybe of Donnie Dungan, you know, coming in like, I will, the casting is really good as far as like an Americanized take on a British story, obviously. Yeah, I just think it's fantastic. If I had one thing I could wish for, it's not a criticism, it's just a wish. It's that, you know, like, we're pretty close to the time where Orson Welles came out with his version of Macbeth, which is told in this very stark, chiaroscuro, hellish, cave-like version of Scotland, right? And Roland V. Lee, coming right out of Son of Frankenstein, I think there was an attempt to make this not only narratively historically pretty close, but like costume wise, set wise, you know, filming wise, make it look like a proper period drama. And I get that. And that's very, that probably has a lot to do with the film's success when it came out and stuff. In another, you know, alternate reality, it would have been interesting to see Roland V. Lee do a kind of German expressionist
Gothic version of
take
yeah.
on this horror story. I would have liked to have seen even like the most recent Macbeth that the Joel Coen directed with Denzel Washington and Frances McDormand. The expressionist style of the set and the lighting and stuff was so incredible. I just thought it was just the most amazing, one of the best black and white things I've ever seen of recent years. It would have been interesting to see the Universal aesthetic a little more prominent in this as a way to tie it into the larger canon of, you know, Universal horror. But, you know, if that is my only visual criticism, that it doesn't look as much like a Universal film as it could, then you know, I still think it's a legitimate, their choice of doing it as a legitimate period drama stands out. And there's still just plenty of, like you're saying, Livia, there's plenty of touchstone Universal stuff. There's all the Karloff stuff, the torture and everything like that. Just enough that I do think that they, the core horror audience at the time could have gone to this and gone, okay, no, it's we buy this as part of the, you know, what we expect to see when we go to a Universal thriller, right?
I think that this definitely is very unique, and it stands out as part of the overall, the just the Universal horror, you know, genre or canon. And there's just enough, you know, like, you know, the music score and with Karloff and Rathbone to some extent, but also with, you know, just a lot of the direction and the lighting and, you know, the fact that there's some really sadistic things in this and some really gruesome stuff that happens. I mean, so it is at every right to be called a horror film, because that's exactly what it is.
Yeah. There's a contemporary account of this showing at the Rialto, which I think was in New York City. I think it might have been LA. I thought the Rialto was New York. I'm not sure. Where someone was saying, one of the critics was saying that people were sort of cheering and enjoying Rathbone's character, you know, iteration as Richard III at the beginning, and as the film kept going on, it got quieter and quieter, and people were just starting to have more and more trouble kind of rooting for Rathbone as he got more, which is like a testament to like that it's working. Like, it's good. Like, you're supposed to sort of admire Richard, like, which I was saying, like, he's so clever, like, you get it.
Very charismatic.
Yes. Yes. But there's this point where he passes this over the line where, and everyone's line is different, but like, there's a point where I think for everyone, probably for most people, when he has the two little kids killed.
Yeah, probably. Lose most people where you do things like that.
Yeah, hopefully. Where he's unforgivable now, you know, and now you're just waiting to see him die. Like, you're waiting to see him pay for what he's done one way or the other, die or be arrested or put in the tower or whatever. It's interesting, but, I do think, and I just want to talk about Karloff just for another minute. And I, like I said, I think, talking about those touchstones of, you know, there's a reason that it's a picture of Boris Karloff on the cover of Tower of London in the silver top editions, right? Because he is the monster of the film. Like he's not. I mean, it's the whole thing where, like, you realize, like, Richard III is actually the monster, but and Mort is just doing what he's told. But Mort physically, I mean, they managed to find a way to make Karloff into this monster of a character, and like I said, it's a look, like, you're never going to confuse Mort with any of the other characters Karloff played in his career. Like, he's a one-off, and it's a brilliant piece of design and makeup on Jack Pierce's part, on top of like the just that one-of-a-kind physique of, you know, of Karloff's face.
Yeah, no, it's a, you know, if this is one that either our listeners really haven't seen, or maybe haven't seen in a while, I would strongly suggest it's a great, great movie, and definitely deserves a lot of views, a lot of attention.
Yeah. Every time, like, it's a little more and stuff like that. And like what I find is, like, after a couple times watching it, like, I get the story, like, I understand what's happening. So now I can kind of really more pay attention to the subtle stuff. And again, like the standout scene with Basil Rathbone and Vincent Price is just, it's like, it's a joy to watch these it two is. Actors that I really adore, who, as far as I know, it's almost the only time I can think of them doing a scene, you know, a scene like this together. Like, a, you know, I don't know if they did another film. Did they do anything else together? Yeah, Rathbone?
In the 60s.
Terror? They were in the 60s. Yeah. Cause they reunited all these.
Yeah. Comedy of Terrors. Comedy
of Terrors and stuff. It's all these ones I keep referencing, and I don't remember any of the names, because I watched them all together at one point, like in the summer, the Terror and that and everything.
And it, like, all probably, and seems all, like
they
the
all
same
blur
movie.
Together. Yeah. Now, yeah. Yeah. That's interesting. That's right. They did that, like, way later, so many years later and stuff like that. That's so interesting. And you see all those great photos of, like, Price and Rathbone and old Lon Chaney Jr. and stuff in the films and stuff that they did.
Yeah.
Still enjoying being boogeymen. Yeah. All right, guys. Hey, this is our episode on 1939's Tower of London. Thanks for listening to us talk about, again, one of those kind of one-off universals. Like, they didn't really do anything else like this before or after this. This was sort of like, I mean, they did traditional, I shouldn't say that, they did traditional historical dramas, but to try and find this hybrid between the doing a historical story and you know, connecting it with their horror shingle. It's probably in one of the box sets you own at home if you collect a lot of Universal stuff. So give it a look.
Oh, yeah, I completely agree with you. This is certainly a hidden gem, I think, in like many of the Universal, you know, classic horror movies. And I don't, there's not been a whole lot, I think, that's really been done or talked about with this movie outside of the commentary and the Blu-ray. So it was great to talk to you about it. And hopefully our listeners can go back and really enjoy this one. So take care, everyone.
Okay. Have a good one. Bye.
Thank you for listening to this episode. But the fun does not stop here. You can follow and interact with the show's hosts and listeners online on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. The Borgo Pass Horror Podcast is a presentation of Shadow Camera Film and Entertainment. This episode was edited by Livio Marino. The music was composed by Sean Poole. Opening and closing narration are by me, Kat Ahrens. Show titles and graphics created by Jim Towns. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you next time on the Borgo Pass Horror Podcast.